Today great. Today is such a great day. Everything is so great.
We're going to have a lot of fun. We got some wonderful people for you.
All you mommies and daddies out there who complain to the radio station, I got something to say to you.
And the first thing you've got to do is say the call letters properly. Okay?
It's an incredible metamorphosis of love and emotion and sensitivity and tenderness and fun and joy and happiness.
Did you know that this show represents health and hope?
Great day to follow the clues on the Amy Beth Arkowitz Show. We've been together a mosaic of voices from the arts, pop culture, personal growth, and justice. How are you? It's a Friday mystery twin bill. Yeah, we're going to welcome two fellow sisters in crime, Vicki Voss, the author of the Antique Hunters mystery series, and award-winning author Jerry Ferris Finger joins us later. So how exciting is that? Hope you'll join us too. If you're listening live, it is, or on podcast, but if you're listening live, you can call us and tweet to us, of course. Friday, November 6th, 9 a.m. out west, 11 central, noon here in the east. Kind of feels like September 6th in my neighborhood because it's so mild out there. How about you? Number in motion, 347-857-4505. Twitter feed, of course, always abuzz 24-7 at AB Writes. I see ya. Yeah, we have a lot of free-flow pop culture convo to talk about, too, as time permits. Carly Fiorina, just on The View. I could spend a whole show on that, but we'll get to it. I see your comments. I will. The show today brought to you in part by Progressive Insurance. Bundling can save you a bundle. Find out more at progressive.com. And by PopNet, arts, culture, and conversation on air online. The new improved PopNet, now featuring select editions of the Amy Beth Arkowitz Show. And this edition is going to be a jam-packed mystery fest as we welcome Vicki Voss to the show. She's the author, as I mentioned, of the Antique Hunters mystery series. The first one, Murder by the Spoonful, I'm just getting into, so I can't divulge anything. No spoilers there. Hey, Vicki, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks, Amy Beth. I appreciate being on the show.
Pleasure to have you here. As I said, I'm just getting into the book, and it's a cozy mystery. I love cozy mysteries, and one of the reasons I do, and one of the reasons I write them, is the great characters that emerge. And it's so intriguing to me that you have two characters, Anne and Cece, who are your amateur sleuths, who are, I understand, real-life characters. So how does that work? They're your real-life friends that you've turned into the stars of your series. I'm wondering how that came about and how they feel about it. Tell us a little bit about that.
You know, actually, they were my inspiration. I spent basically two summers. They're my best friends, and we went to all these antique stores, estate sales, flea markets, garage sales, traveling around basically the Chicago area. And then I was thinking, oh, I want to write a book to get away from the drone of my day job, and a mystery book, and it just emerged. And we started writing about my one friend, Anne, and how extreme she is shopper-wise, and one thing led to another, and the book just evolved. And once we started, I told them, and I had them read it to make sure, because we did use their real names. We actually ended up changing those slightly, but ended up sharing that with them and having them read it before we went out to publishers and everything. I wanted to make sure they were okay and weren't offended by anything that was in the book, but they've
That's
actually
a good idea,
enjoyed
Andy.
It. So it's been a lot of fun.
So you didn't tell them ahead of time. You wrote it, and then you said, hey, you want to read this? And then were they shocked to find themselves in the book?
I think I had dropped hints along the way because I was still going out on the weekends shopping with them, so I had dropped hints, and I'd ask them for opinions on things, especially Anne and Cece know much more about the antique world than I did at the time. They were kind of teaching me things to look for and everything, so I dropped hints along the way, but I think they were really surprised as it progressed and to find out that they were these amateur sleuths who stumbled upon a murder and had to solve it.
What a hoot. I mean, so obviously they approved. They must have gotten a kick out of it, I guess.
Yeah, they've had a lot of fun. They've been both busy promoting it. They've showed up. I did a signing at a local antique store, and they both showed up and were busy promoting it, passing out bookmarks at the antique show. I told people these are the real life inspirations. So they've been really supportive.
That's so great. Hey, that's a great marketing tool. Put your friends in a book. Find your most popular friends. Put them in a book, and they'll do some of the work for you. I like that. It is really fascinating. But you have a lot of knowledge about antique hunting, as you call it, and looking all these great details, which I think is also the backdrop of so many cozy mysteries, you know, the intimate details of the characters' lives and all the great fabric, you know, the pictures that you can kind of create with your descriptions and so forth that you have in there, as well as, of course, the murder in the middle. Now, you said you always wanted to write a murder mystery. What was the driving force behind that? Were you a voracious reader of mysteries as a kid and beyond, or it just came to you one day, hey, just to be fun?
It started early on. I remember being in second grade, and I won a writing contest. I wrote a mystery, just a short story mystery for, like, a writing class, whatever they call it back then. I'm reading, you know, years ago, but it was, like, The Secret of the Topaz Ring, and I won an award for it. And I just have always been fascinated by mysteries, and then as I got older, I read all of Agatha Christie and Georgette Heyer, both her romance, but also the mysteries. I always enjoyed them because they had that element of, yes, there's a mystery, there's a murder, but there's also a lot of fun. Her characters are always really interesting and compelling. So it wasn't just as much suspenseful as, you know, bringing you into the character's world and what's going on, whether it's living in a little English countryside or being, you know, traveling on the Nile. I always enjoy that aspect as much as the mystery. But even now, I just finished John Grisham's new book, so I still read a lot of mystery suspense.
Oh, how was that?
It was good. I have to say I like his older books better. This one seemed more of a character study. It didn't seem as much plot-driven to me. But it was interesting, and I'm not quite sure that I've resolved. I just finished it this morning, so I'm not quite sure I've resolved myself to the ending yet.
Yeah, sometimes you have to work it out. It is fascinating because I think he got some blowback when he kind of went away from his, you know, earlier suspense novels and started to write things that weren't even suspense at all, and he wrote a couple of nonfiction books. So when you become so successful and known for one kind of writing, people expect that, I think, you know, so... you know, it's easier for those of us who are not quite as successful yet. You can kind of play around. I always say obscurity has its advantages. You know, you can jump around from genre to genre a little bit. You can experiment more. There's a more liberating aspect to that, I think, when you get pigeonholed as only a suspense writer or only a mystery writer sometimes. It's harder to break away because your fans expect it, you know, to replicate the last success of the last book. So it's tough. And not that I would love to try it out, John. No. I'd love to try out that level of success.
I think there's something to be said for that because, you know, I come from a nonfiction background. My background was as a journalist for years, for a number of those, for the Chicago Tribune. So now my editor's like, you're writing mysteries? And then, you know, you're writing cozy mysteries? Like, that's a, I don't want to say a slam, but, you know, not quite as accepted as if I was writing literary fiction. But I'm like, I enjoy it. It's very fun for me to come up with the situations, the characters. At this point, the real-life Anne and Cece are probably a little more removed from the fictional Anne and Cece, and they live in my head more so than the actual people do. But I think there's something to be said for breaking out of a genre or trying a different genre and, you know, experimenting. I think that's one of the freedoms we have as writers.
Yeah, exactly. You know, why let yourself be handcuffed to something if you want to break out and try different things? I mean, I'm always encouraging people to go with it. Try it. I mean, you don't know. You might not be as successful in one thing as another, but why not try it? It's interesting you mentioned that you have a journalistic background, as so many of us do, because that's a good place to start in many cases. And I know our next guest also has a journalist background, Jerry Ferris Finger, who worked at the Atlanta Constitution for years. What do you take away from that, besides, of course, my experience as a journalist, deadlines, although lately I haven't been with my own personal deadlines when I set my own deadlines, but I never missed a deadline when I had articles to write and columns to do. There's something about having to get it done that I think if you're instilled with that discipline, it sticks with you. Do you agree? And talk about
that. Yeah, I think that for me, at least my first job as a journalist, I was a general assignment reporter covering everything from accidents to school boards to, you know, know, a llama farm. I mean, it was just craziness. taking my own pictures, and then, you know, these were back in the old days, so you'd have to come and do your own layout as well. I think it really teaches you, like you said, that discipline. I mean, you know, I hear so much about writer's block. My problem is I don't have enough time to write all the ideas in my head. Mm-hmm. You know, it just is maintaining a flow, and even knowing that if you don't necessarily have the right words, to at least sit down and do some writing, and that it'll work out. I find for me, and this is even in the old days when I wrote, especially feature articles, that my ideas usually come not when I'm at the computer or sitting at a typewriter, that it's when I'm walking my dog or in the shower or exercising, when I, you know, the ideas, the characters or whatever are still in my head. But the idea doesn't really emerge necessarily when I'm sitting in front of the computer trying to force it. Though as a journalist, you have to do that at some point because you have to get the story done. And like you said, not miss a deadline. I mean, I was a freelance writer for 6 years. And, you know, if as a freelancer, if you miss a deadline, nobody's going to hire you. So it puts a lot of pressure on you to, you know, to perform.
Well, it's funny, though, because I never had a problem with it. In other words, I knew what the deadline was, and that was the impetus. I had to get to it, so you have to get it done. I think when you have more freedom and you're making your own deadline, writing fiction or whatever it may be, you maybe cut yourself some slack, or you give in to the writer's block, or you, you know, I'm not going to say make excuses, but sometimes there's more wiggle room there because you have to get these other things done. And if you're, as many of us do, have a juggling act of other jobs that you're doing, those usually have some pressures to perform and get something done by a certain time. And sometimes people tend to backburner their writing. And do you find that to be the case where, okay, I'll get to it, but I know I have to get this other task done for my other job first. And then by the time you're ready to go, you don't either have enough energy or there's a knock on the door and there's, you know, a neighbor with an issue or there's a child who has a problem or whatever it may be. Do you find that?
Yeah, there is that. I mean, I have a full-time job that's not related. I mean, it's in the editing field, but it's not related to my fiction writing. And it's difficult because you try and take care of yourself. You try and exercise and, you know, between work and everything else, like you said, there's all those demands. But I try to make it a point to at least write 2 pages every weeknight and then at least 10 pages every weekend day. So because I'm driven, I mean, this is for me, I really have enjoyed it, and I've enjoyed the antique hunters and seeing kind of the little bit of the success they've had, and I really enjoy writing the characters. They're very fun for me. And so now instead of spending my weekends scouring antique stores and estate sales and everything, I'm spending it at my computer in the real life. Anne and Cece are getting a little irritated with me because I'm not spending my weekend shopping with them. So it's
finding
that balance. Yeah,
they're
going to
be cursing their fictional alter egos. Yeah.
That's what I told him. I said blame the Spoon Sisters for this because I really want to write the next book and see where it goes.
So you have a passion for it, which I think is so important because, you know, a lot of people listen to the show are aspiring writers, and they always want to know what fuels people. First of all, the discipline, what you do, and as you said, you try to write 2 pages a night, however long that may take you. You try to make sure you're writing 10 pages a day on each weekend day. So there is a certain discipline that you've instilled or imposed upon yourself to get things done. And I think that's important. And you also, obviously, it sounds like have this great passion for it. You really enjoy doing it. You want to explore these characters more. You want to improve as a writer, et cetera. So that's kind of the best advice I always give people is if you have something that you love, you have to cultivate. And just thinking about it is not the same as actually doing it. Yeah, go ahead.
You know, actually, it started about 10 years ago. My husband and I wrote a science fiction novel together, which is going to be published. We have a publisher for it, but that probably won't be published till this January. But the interesting thing was that taught me that, you know, those nighttime hours that I could be watching TV the TV doesn't matter in the long run. It's leaving this, you know, this work behind for me. Like I said, I enjoy it. The one, the science fiction novel we wrote is actually loosely based. I went to Africa for World Relief and was in southern Sudan for a month writing about the stories there and what the people there were experiencing. And I was so moved by what I learned and the people there. This science fiction novel evolved out of it. And And the guy, the man who was my guide, is actually turned into one of the main characters, loosely based on him.
There
and
you go again.
I maybe that's the journalist in me, is I pull on people I know, so I don't have to do any research into characters I don't. but it just evolved from there, and then the mystery is like I just have had so much fun with it. It has been a lot of fun to write these scenarios that are loosely based in truth, but not necessarily true. My newest one is about my next door neighbor. She's 75 years old, and we call her the Neighborhood Watch, and she just takes care of the neighborhood. And so I wrote this book about her and how she stumbles upon a murder in the neighborhood, and it's up to her to solve it because the police don't know what they're doing. And so she read it, and she was just cracking up the whole time. So it's been
very
fun.
Oh, so you have yet another series with another real person as a star. I love this. This is a great gimmick or a great way to do it. I love and you have a second, Antique Hunters. It's funny because the first one came out not too long ago, and then you published the second one right away because I think you said you know, my idea is I like to pace it out so that people want more later. But your idea, and there's no right or wrong on this, is that you think you want to build up the momentum so people can, you know, just want to keep reading them, I suppose. As long as you can write them that fast, I think that's okay.
Well, the first one, actually, it came out in June, but we'd actually written it a year before. I mean, it took that long to find, it's published with Cozy Cat Press, and it took that long to find a publisher. So we actually didn't have a contract with her till May of this year, but the book had been finished before then.
Yes. So, no, I understand.
So that took a while. So the second one was just pure fun for me. My husband and I took a road trip this summer from Chicago, driving around Nashville, and the whole story originated out of that road trip. And while we were driving, I had my iPad mini in my lap with a keyboard, and I was typing away. And it just was so much fun, and it just, I don't know whether it's the characters or the situations, but they kind of write themselves. It's the first time I've really experienced that, where it's not a lot of painstaking work. Obviously, the first draft is really a first draft. It's very rough. It's very much an outline. I'm very much a stream of consciousness writer, where it's just a rough, very rough first draft, and then I go back the second draft and flush it out, the third draft, and so on until probably about the fifth draft, where it's probably ready for public consumption, at least on a smaller scale.
Right, I know what you're saying. But you talk about, as a mystery author, this is always fascinating to me, too, because I generally also write stream of consciousness, just let it all come out organically. But I find with mysteries, you kind of have to do at least something of a plot, not necessarily, you know, outline. I never do a detailed outline, and I sometimes get myself in trouble that way with the various detours the characters take. But you kind of have to plant the clues, right? So you have to sort of know. I mean, how do you reconcile that? Do you have an outline at first, or you just go with it and then shape it later?
I have an outline in my head of where I think it's going to go. And so I'll start, like, I'm working on one now that's about, it's about a new character, and this one's going to take me longer because it does require a lot of research. But going back and, you know, I'm planting some clues now because I think I know where I want to go, but now I was discussing it, my husband and I were discussing it yesterday, and now it's kind of going into a separate pattern than what I originally thought, so now I have to go back and fix some things that were clues that were dropped earlier. So there's always some of that where you, by the time you reach the end, you have to go back and fix the beginning. So I try not to, in the past, and this is why it's taking me so long to get published, is I would start writing, and I would never finish because I would always spend my time going back and correcting things that happened before. Now I'm just trying to push through it, get that first draft, and then go back.
I think that's a wise idea. Don't worry about it so much. You can correct it later. Just keep going. But it is funny, and it is kind of frustrating and fascinating at the same time when I think, people will say, well, do you know who did it? And I'm like, I think so. And then I find out later I didn't really know who did it. I thought it was somebody else. And then, of course, as you said, you have to kind of trace yourself back and make sure that the clues are in agreement with what the real culprit really is.
Murder by the Spoon, so I'm not going to give anything away, but really the person who ends up being the bad person, the murderer, is not who I thought it was going to be at the beginning by a long shot. It just kind of evolved that way, and then we had to go back and make sure that everything matched and there was nothing that gave that away. I mean, it was just, as you said, you have to go back and make sure that you're not, you know, leading it too far astray or leading too many clues or dropping the wrong kind of clues or...
Yeah, you don't want it to be too obvious, but you don't want it to be so crazy that nobody could possibly figure it out if they tried. You know?
I know, I get irritated with those books where, like, 10 pages in, you're like, oh, I know who did it.
Right. Well, you think the good ones, or you think you know who did it, and then you find, oh, wait, I'm totally wrong. But, you know, it's good if, you know, when people say, well, I didn't see it coming, but then I always say, well, did it make sense when you see it? And, oh, yeah, it totally made sense. So that's what I like. I want to surprise people, but I don't want people to be like, well, she pulled somebody out of left field. How could I possibly figure that out? You know, because that is
gypped
on either end. You know, if it's too obvious or if it's too, you can't possibly figure it out because they pulled somebody out who, you know, oh, look, it was this, or they woke up, it was all a dream, you know, whatever the old amateur, you know, pitfalls are. But I think discovering the discovery process as you're writing and letting it go organically makes it a better book. I mean, I think what happens to some people who are so rigid in their outlines and they know exactly what happens from beginning to end and they stick with it because there's no they don't let themselves have the leeway for there to be a surprise or a detour, because I think that's organically when the real writing comes out. So you think you know where it's going, but then your characters surprise you. I mean, I find the characters kind of take on their own life your characters already have their own lives, but that's another story. And then you know, they follow you through. They kind of pull me where I need to go in the story, and sometimes it is unusual, unexpected terrain.
Exactly. I mean, like I said, the Spoon Sisters, when I started this, it started more as a joke with, you know, my friend. I was just kind of goofing around, and then one thing led to another, and then it became evolved into this whole murder mystery, and then it became her character really took on her own life and became the star of the story, and it's been an evolving process, and now, I mean, book three, I haven't started it yet, is in my head, and I can hear her speaking, so I'm like, well, maybe I should work on that first before this other one, just because these characters are really alive for me.
That's it, the loudest. That's why I always say I have a lot of characters and cast of characters in my head, but the loudest group, the loudest character, the story that is the one that has to come out the next, because that's the one that, you know, has that urgency about it. And I know a lot of people think we're crazy as writers, and I guess we are. So I always say it's like, in other sectors it would be a diagnosis. You know, you hear all the voices in your head. You know? but you can control them. We can control them, and if you don't live with them and you don't let them come out, they will go away. So, you know, the idea that you said when you sit down at the computer, you're not always the most productive, because your stories are, you know, come to you when you're, you know, doing something else. You have to at some point get to that computer or notepad or whatever it is you're working on to make sure that you let them out. Otherwise, they're going to find someplace else, I think, to go to get their stories out. So don't let them linger too long or let them go dormant too long. If they're in there and ready to come out, let them come out.
Oh, definitely. I've started tweaking with the third book, but I've got two paragraphs written, and I've been working on this other story, and I really want to get that one done first. So, but I'm jotting down the ideas as they come to me, just so I have them for when I'm ready.
You'll see. You'll see which one comes first. You never know. It might surprise you. It's a fascinating conversation for sure. Vicki Voss, pleasure to have you on the show. The Antique Hunters Mysteries are out. Murder by the Spoonful is the first one. What's the second one called?
Picking Murder.
Picking Murder. And that's the road trip. That's also great that you're doing the road trip thing, because, you know, if they stay in one area too, you know, too long, the value of the houses go down, you know.
Well, this was, I was reading something, I think it was in Writer's Digest about, or maybe it was a mystery writer who was writing in and saying, you know, I'm on my 13th book in this series, this character lives in this small town. Does there really have to be a murder in this book, or can I just do some kind of mystery? Because aren't people going to wonder why there's so many murders in this little small town? And I thought, you know, that's so true.
Suspension of disbelief, it's all part of the thing that readers have to bring to it, that we all kind of in on the gag. But yeah, there are some mysteries. Not as many, but there are some mysteries where there isn't a murder. And I think I had an author I spoke with, Charles Salzberg, who writes detective stories, and he doesn't have a murder. It's other kinds of things, missing people and other things. And his rationale is because most people love mysteries, and most people encounter some mysteries in their lives, but most people don't encounter murders. But yet most mysteries are murder mysteries, so it is interesting. So I guess you could do it without a murder, but it usually has. The beauty of a cozy mystery is the murder happened, but however gruesome it may be, there's not as much time spent dwelling on the gruesome facts as much as it is about the solving of the case and the, you know, all the great side stories, the romance, the quirky relationships, the great characters and all of that. So.
Exactly.
Oh, but I'm drawn to, I guess, yeah.
Yeah, I
Although
think
I like
it's
thrillers, too. I don't know if I would, I don't like a lot of gore, so I don't want to do a lot of gruesome description if I can avoid it as a writer. As a reader,
no,
I can,
exactly.
You know.
I covered court trials for a while, and, you know, it was interesting because at times they'd have to release, you know, photos of murder trials and photos and things like that, and I'm like, I don't want to see those, and then the jurors had to see them, so I don't know whether anyone really wants to encounter that much graphic nature in a book that you're reading for pleasure, unless you're interested in that, obviously, but I like more the low tone, the cozy aspect of it where, you know, there's that element of their daily lives, and this is interrupting their daily lives, but they need to figure it out, and but they're still going about their daily lives, which I think is what I liked about the Spoon Sisters Antique Hunters so much is, you know, they're still real people, and they're still going about their daily lives.
Yeah, Anne's still looking for the perfect diet, right? Is she still looking for the perfect diet on book two?
Yeah, she's still on her diet search in book two, and probably book three might be off the diet for a little bit.
Okay. Well, the holidays are coming. We're all going to be off the diet for a little bit, okay?
I know.
Great fun, really great fun, and great talking to you. I think you've offered some inspiration and you know, enthusiasm to people who are both readers and writers to get out there, read your books, of course. That's the important thing. And if you want to write one, just start doing it and see if it grabs you, and the story will pull you through. Again, the Antique Hunters Mysteries, Vicki Voss is the author, Murder by the Spoonful and the Pickin Murders. VickiVoss.com, yes, is the place to go for all the details, available at Amazon, Barnes & Noble, I'm assuming, you know, wherever fine books are sold. You can ask at your local bookstores if you're fortunate enough to have one. And we thank you so much for coming with us, Vicki. I hope you come back and see us when you have another adventure to share.
I definitely will. Thanks so much, Amy Beth. It's been fun.
You're very welcome. Thank you, Vicki. Take care. Vicki Voss again, the details at VickiVoss.com. As always, I will post it on our website. Jerry Ferris Finger comes up next. Stick around on the Amy Beth Erkley Show. By the way, you can reach us via Twitter, AB Writes. I know we have some commentary for our pop culture conversation a bit later. We'll get to it when we can. Phone line is also open if you're listening live on Friday, November 6th, 9 a.m. out west. Well, I guess 9:27 out west. Follow along, 11:27, 12:27 Eastern Time, 347-857-4505. So let's welcome Jerry Ferris Finger to the show. She is a former journalist, now novelist. Popular series, award-winning series, in fact, the first book in the series won an award, so officially an award-winning author joins us. Her latest book is Running with Wild Blood. Jerry Ferris Finger joins us. Hey, Jerry, thank you so much for joining us. How are you today?
I'm fine. Thank you for having me.
A pleasure to have you here. This is, I believe, Running with Wild Blood. Is it your fifth book in the Mariah Drew Richard Lake mystery series?
Yes, it is. Yes, it is. Number five.
So let's talk a little bit about your transition. I know I was fascinated to learn that you were not only a journalist, worked for some years at the Atlanta Constitution, but your mentor for a while was the humorist Louis Grizzard. Now, how did you get to hook up with him, and how did that all work out for you?
Yeah, Louis Grizzard. That's, you know, he's would be, I mean, he is the late Louis Grizzard. at the newspaper, I just started editing his columns, and he liked my work, and so we made a pact, the newspaper, Lewis and I, that I would handle his columns. And then when he went into books, the books were a collection of his columns. I edited those for his publisher, and at the book publisher. So, I made suggestions. I did research for him, and if somewhere along in my other reporting, I found something that he could turn into a humorous column, I made suggestions, and he was just a great guy to work for. He was absolutely, he was a mentor in that the way newspapers are columns and articles are written, and the spareness and the leaving out of words that are not necessary. And I mean, if you write right, you don't need words like suddenly something happened or beautifully or any of the adjectives, adverbs. And so it really does speed up your writing. And I have to say, I am known for moving the plot along, not getting bogged down in beautiful writing because of my newspaper background.
That helps. That's like Elmer Leonard had those the idea. I cut out all the things that people don't like.
Right, exactly.
not perfect. A description of the weather and the scenery. Yeah, to get to. Was he a funny guy?
He was very funny.
Well,
he had it later on in his career. He was a stand-up comedian.
Yes. Yes, I am.
And he was very funny, but he was also very serious. And sometimes, he would be in his office at the newspaper, and someone that didn't know him would stick their head in his office and say something, and Lewis would just look at him like, "What?" I mean, he was working, and he wasn't. Most people, when people are working hunched over their computer, he worked on a typewriter, by the way, but hunched over their typewriter, they don't get interrupted and expect, kind of a soft shoe act to go on
or
funniness spewing out of the mouth. And so, he had his serious side, and he was a serious man politically and socially, but he just had a way of looking at the world through Southern eyes that appealed to people even internationally. The Japanese absolutely loved him. They bought all of his books. I mean, they just absolutely loved him.
All right, let's talk about your books and how you got started. I mean, what attracted you to the genre? Why did you decide, hey, I want to write some mysteries? And obviously you've been quite successful doing so. In general, what's the attraction to mysteries for you?
Well, I think, the genre in, the broad scope of mysteries, the tension, and I think that if you're writing from mainstream to cozy, that you have to have some tension in your books. And a lot of that comes through, the worst crime in the world, the worst crimes in the world, and, murder being right there at the top. But I would say specifically, I enjoyed reading all of the old 30s and 40s mystery writers. My mother was a great reader of a lot of them. And then I got into Christie and Nigel Marsh and Ruth Rendell. And I just liked that genre. I tried one time to write a cozy, and it just turned into kind of a dark cozy. You know,
you like the darker side. You gravitate a little bit to
the darker. I do like the darker stuff. I do like. I mean, Drew and Lake are involved in murder, and they are professionals, and they go after, seriously go after the bad guys. And you know, there's blood running in the streets when in my work. So it's. Yeah, verges on, and I think a lot of it is Running with Wild Blood is definitely a thriller. Some of my earlier work, I would say The Last Temptation and The Endgame, except for the end of The Endgame, were a little bit just mysteries rather than. But there's always mystery in my work. I want to find out as the story unfolds when I'm reading books what the mystery and what it's about and see if I can figure it out. So
yeah.
That's why I write mysteries, even with a thriller aspect.
So it's more explicit than the cozies for you. You get
oh, yeah.
a little darker, and there's more description about the actual crime scene and that kind of thing. But you still want to have follow the clues, which I think is, I agree. When you're reading a mystery, you
oh,
want
yeah.
to follow
oh,
along
yeah.
and
the
it.
Twist and the twist
and the twist
and you know and but be fair
and the characters
yeah
and the characters of course and by now on the fifth book people who are reading the whole series I'm sure are invested in Mariah Drew and Richard Lake and. Their personal lives, as well as you know, what's at stake for them
following
each of these crimes. Yeah, I mean,
right.
you find that
that's
with readers. True. The more you do it, I mean, I find that I've only had two out so far in the same series where they are really invested. Oh, what's going to happen? Are they going to get together? You know, they're interested in the romantic side stories and all of that. So, I think
mm-hmm.
that's one of the fun things about a series that the readers become so invested in the characters.
Yes, that's true. And I have had a reason recently to go back and read The Endgame, which parts of The Endgame, which came out in 2010. That's, you know, just 5 years ago. And, of course, I wrote it 2008 or 2009, somewhere around there. And I could see clearly how their relationships, how their careers have evolved unto themselves and both together. So I think maybe I do it maybe a little more unconsciously than consciously. But, you know, different plots require them to do different things and show different sides of their character and personalities.
And they're more in the big city too, right?
Yes, Atlanta. And I mean, I take them to in the Last Temptation. My husband and I went to Palm Springs to play golf, and I was so entranced with the characters and the streets and the whole ambience of Palm Springs. And I got to write. And so that's the second book. I got to write about them. So I mean, it's not a big city, but it's like a big city with the you know with all the Hollywood characters that live there.
Sure.
and it's sophisticated. And then in my fourth book, Murmurs of Insanity, that goes from Atlanta to Athens, Georgia, which is the home of the University of Georgia. And so there's a lot of sophistication there, although Athens is not a big city. So I
anywhere
like
where
to,
there are people, there's intrigue, right?
Right. And in Running with Wild Blood, we go to Florida. And that takes them all the way down to Miami and Miami Beach and the incredible, well, what should I say? Miami Beach, the South Shore, is South Beach is just incredible. And so they get to mix and mingle, going from riding with Wild Blood, which is a motorcycle gang, and then in their quest to find the missing friend of the murdered girl, Julia Trapp, the missing girl's Bunny Radisson, and in their endeavor to find her, it takes them to South Beach. So, you know, that was kind of neat to write about.
a lot of different intriguing locales. And,
yeah, well, I've been there. You know, in my journalistic work, I've been to these places,
right.
And so it's easy to write about them. It's fun to write
about.
Talk
to us about your process in terms of, do you have the story already plotted out when you get started, or do you just start writing and see where the characters lead you? How does it work for you?
I think there's a little bit of both. I like to know into maybe a quarter into the book who is the bad guy, who I'm writing towards, in other words. But I'm a scene builder. I do not outline. And that has its own special set of problems, because if you don't have a roadmap, which, you know, by the seat of your pants, you don't, then...
I know that all too well.
You know, that sometimes your characters get ahead of themselves and you have to go
mm-hmm.
back and write something forward for them or take something out, because
yes.
you can't possibly have a character who's never been introduced all of a sudden pop up. So,
right.
you know, that's
yeah.
a special set of problems.
But
I love it that way.
Yeah, me too, because you kind of discover it. I let the characters kind of take me where they need to go, and then, of course, sometimes I think I know where it's going and I'm wrong and I have to go back. But, you know, that's all part of the fun and part of the process.
Yeah.
Do you envision this? Do you have an idea of how many books you're going to have in the series, or are you just going to keep doing them until you get sick of it?
Well, yeah, I will until I get sick of it. I don't see that now. I have my next book is coming out, the sixth, is coming out in May, it's called American Nights, and it's really kind of timely. It's about a Saudi prince who marries an American girl and has a little girl by her, and his wife and daughter disappear, and he hires Drew to find them. Now, you know, I'm not going to tell you anymore. But
you don't tell me anymore.
Is he a good guy or a bad guy? You know, I mean, this is...
Yeah.
And this was... The fun of writing that book is I vacillated. I didn't know if he was a good guy or a bad guy myself. So.
Yeah, yeah.
But
anyway, that's part of the
yeah.
fun, right? I mean, for you to find out as the writer what it is you need to know about the characters and the story is just as much fun as it is, hopefully, for the reader. When they finally
right.
get
and
the
I let them, hand. I let them, my characters, particularly in American Nights, tell their own story. And
yeah.
even though all my books in the series are written in first person through Drew's eyes, she has a lot of conversation and investigation of him. And
right.
like she does in all her books, all the characters are vetted to their back teeth. And you get to know them. And then I use a lot of dialogue. And I think that, like in real life, what people say is, and how you interpret what they say and how they say it, is
yes.
what you think of them, what you conclude about their character and personalities.
Also moves the story along. I find that too. I'm also a playwright, so I'm natural at dialogue, so I do find
yeah.
it moves the story along nicely. Yeah. Tell us a little bit about the nuts and bolts for you, your process. I mean, do you have a certain set time when you write every day? Do you have a certain number of hours or pages or words? I mean, how does it work for you in terms of setting your schedule up and adhering to it?
Well, I have a lot of friends in the writing business, and you too, I'm sure, that love to get up, crack of dawn, get to their desk. I am not like that.
I've tried that. It doesn't quite work well for me.
No, I like to get everything that the day is going to throw at me out of the way so
uh-huh.
I don't have lingering things. It could be, you know, folding socks or taking my dog to the vet or just, you know, Well, of course, we have a lot of marketing to do for our books. So, you know, marketing, I do that. That kind of, you know, just workaday world stuff in the morning. And so I usually, right after lunch, I figure everything, you know, my plate's clear, and I don't have to worry about anything hanging for me to do. So then, and I really do not like people to interrupt me then, because, and my husband knows that. You know, if my office door is closed,
yeah.
I don't care who it is on the phone, you know.
Better be an emergency or forget it, right?
It better be an emergency is right. So, I mean, that's because I really do concentrate, and I don't write more than probably 3 hours. After 3 hours of concentration and focus, my brain is done. You know, it's time to...
You just know when you're done. You just kind of feel
it's time
this is enough for today.
Yeah, it's time to take the dog for a walk or go do something else, you know, so... But, yeah, Now, I found in my earlier books, I was a little bit more scattered about my time, so... Over time, I learned what I needed to do to be the most productive, to get the most out.
And what was
that? Well, just don't be scattered during the day. Don't write a paragraph and say, oh, no, now I have to go to the grocery store, or a page, and I'll go to the grocery store. Sometimes that's good if you need to work through a scene or work into another scene to take a break. But I usually, I know where the story's going, and I know where it's going to go for the next probably, 5,000 words, you know, so that I can sit down and make the best use of my time.
Do you find it's a good idea
about.
to leave something that you know is going to be happening the next day, so that you have impetus to, you know, you're not going to sit there and not have anything to write about because you really know where you're going, so you get a jump start on the next session. Does that help you?
I mean, that's kind of like everybody should do that, because it just, you're left with something, and then you know you're going to start with something.
Exactly. That's what I always say. Don't finish it up where you don't know where you're going tomorrow, because then you might be more blocked or intimidated or you know, make excuses for not showing up, because then I know I got to get to this. I'm leaving it near. I'm dangling. I know where I am, and I can just jump right in. I think that helps.
All of a sudden, the laundry has to be folded extra neatly. These are just you know, tactics. Stall tactics, because I don't know where I'm going.
Although wasn't it Agatha Christie who said the best time to write is while you're doing the dishes, or the ideas start coming in? So when you're doing other things, sometimes the ideas and the characters will start, you know, percolating. So.
Yeah, they will. And also at night. I mean, I wake up and I used to have a, when I was single, and had a tape recorder that I use. I know it's not tape recorder anymore, but I used to have it at my bedside, and then I would ramble on about, you know, what my great idea was about. Well, the next morning it wasn't such a great idea.
You're right.
but now that I'm married, that doesn't work. I have a pen.
You can jot it down
pencil.
On a pad. I do that, but of course my handwriting is so horrible that by the time I'm like, what was I talking about? Especially in the dark.
Right. Well, we have a dark dog on a very dark floor, so we have lots of night lights all around. So, I mean, I can at least see what I'm writing, but it doesn't make any more sense than when I was talking into a recorder.
Yeah, I know, it's funny how things can seem brilliant at three in the morning that are not so brilliant at the light of day. But you got to go for it anyway. You know, because otherwise, if you didn't record it or write it down, then you'd say, oh my God, I had that brilliant idea, I lost it. So you got to do it anyway and then get it out of the way and throw it out the next day. So.
Yeah. Well, you never know. what where these inspirations are coming from. I mean, you can be in the checkout line, and you can be, you know, on a golf course, or you can be walking the dog, or just talking to people who may be a little boring, and your mind wanders off. And I mean, you never know where these. Oh yeah, that's what I could have Drew do. Oh, that's where I could have her go. Oh yeah, that's great. So. You know, I mean, that's what just having no outline does to you. And I know outline writers do the same thing. I mean, everybody, writers, people who write because they love to write, and go through basically the same processes to get where they're going, I think.
Well, there always has to be some leeway, I guess, because, you know, that's why if you're too rigid, I don't think anybody can be too rigid, because sometimes detours happen or something. You know, you have to go
with the
prizes that come along organically.
Yeah.
Otherwise, I think you're missing out, and the story will be...
No, that's true. That's true.
...will be hurt for it,
true.
I think.
Mm-hmm.
But it's fascinating, and you keep going with the series, which I think is very impressive. Do you have other things in the works as well beyond the series?
I am writing because I have, yes, I do have another. I have two books in the series written that are not even at the publishers yet. So I am writing another. It's meant to be a standalone, and somehow I always venture off into, you know, something that could be a series. But It's a novel based around the early history of one of Georgia's Atlanta suburbs' rich heritage, the ferry boat, the flat boat. We have a lot of streets named, you know, Paces Ferry and Crossings and Powers Ferry and Chester's Crossings because of the river that winds through Atlanta and the suburbs. And so I'm writing a novel that harks back a little bit from the present time back to when the flatboats, the ferry boat business started in about 1813. So I love history. And I love research.
Is it going to be a mystery in that too? Or a different type of book?
Yes, it's going to be a mystery. Yeah. Everything's a mystery.
Yeah. Well, that's true. Life
is a mystery. Is a mystery.
Filled with mysteries. Jerry Ferrisfinger, pleasure talking with you. Your latest book, Running with Wild Blood, is out now. You got a couple more coming, so readers will be looking forward to that. Best place to find out, your website, is that right? Where's your... Give us that
My website and my blog. My website is... my website is up to date. The usual W's at jerryferrisfinger.com, and then jerryferrisfinger.blogspot.com. And I write my blog pretty much, and you know, I'm on Facebook, all those things that we are on.
Yeah,
you know, Facebook.
We'll post
Twitter.
The link for the websites after the show, along with the podcast, which will be available shortly after the show. Pleasure having you on, and good luck with the rest of your endeavors, and come back and see us again.
Oh, I will. Thank you very much. It was fun.
Thank you, Jerry. Jerry Ferrisfinger, jerryferrisfinger.com. As I said, I will post all the aforementioned links on Twitter and Facebook when the show is over. Meantime, we still have a little show time to get to. Twitter feed abuzz at AB Writes, phone line 347-857-4505. And yes, we earned it today for sure. Our producer, Trudy Hart, it is her theme song when we have a mystery author on.
I love a murder mystery upon the radio. I love it, I love it, I really love it so. The heroine is yelling while a sponsor goes on selling.
Don't touch me, you brute! Use delirium for your tube.
Sam shovels in the hovel, he must grovel for a clue. I love it, I love it, I rally, rally do. Charlie comes to give his owns, interrupted by the sponsor.
You see Watson, when the villain.
Painless Joe will do you thriller. I'm nervous when I turn the dial, I'm dizzy in the head. When it's time for in a stankum, I go underneath my bed.
Don't shoot me, Biggs the Stoolie, as they put him through the mill.
I'll shoot you, I'll shoot you. Seriously, I will. The girl he tries to take, and then we have a station break.
Come on, baby, come to me. Boing, boing, boing. This is station COD.
He's not breathing. But how can he? He's dead. He's dead? Why, this is a job for Superman, or Hopper Longevity, or Jack Headstrong, the All-American Boy, or Jerry Lewis. But I don't scare easily, not me. I'm too frightened to be scared. I'll find the killer. I'll search the apartment. Aha! Just as I thought. Three shoes under the bed. Well, that's logical for a man with 3 feet. But I have it now, Inspector. I can name you killer for you. His name is...
Painless Joe will do you drillin'.
My flesh begins to creep and then my skin begins to crawl. You think I was a worm the way I wiggled down the hall. I love a murder mystery upon the radio. I love it, I love it, I really love it so. I love it when I'm listening late at night and a murderer is stalking a heroine. And a hero is stalking a murderer and a private eye is stalking a hero. And a cop is stalking a private eye. And they're coming in closer and closer. Surely, but closer and surely. They're coming out of the radio. Now they're stalking me. What have I done? I was only listening to the radio. Now they're throwing toothpaste at me. They're coming closer and closer. And I don't know the conjunctive rules of anyone that may be based on the fact that other people say the same their facts. Where else are the crescendo? And certainly not the one in Rio. I'm not going up to know that anyone else may say I'm wrong. And I feel that I must stay here now. No one else will ever know the facts.
I wish I was dead.
That one today, Jerry Lewis, of course. I love a murder mystery upon the radio on the Amy Beth Orkowitz Show, closing down our mystery twin bill with mystery and thriller authors Jerry Ferris Finger and Vicky Voss of the Cozy Variety. Thank you both, ladies, for coming by. We will post, as I said, their links to their websites on Twitter and Facebook after the show, along with the podcast. And don't forget, all the shows are archived for podcasts. You can follow the Amy Beth Orkowitz Show on a slew of places, including Stitcher, get the app, we're portable there, the Mixcloud family, BTR, of course, iTunes, NetNow, and select editions available on the PopNet and the Arts Radio Network, and, of course, all roads lead back to the website, amybetharkowy.com. That's a place to stop by, too, with your Inspiration to Action Challenge success stories. Today we want to salute Verna, who is working on painting, and she says poetry as well. So I like these. We have a lot of these visual artists and poets and novelists out there, too, which is so great because those things do go hand in hand. Creativity comes forth in oh so many ways. And Verna says she enjoyed doing the challenge because it reconnected her to her creative force. She says, you're so right. It is like meditation or almost like a prayer. I don't want to get too fancy on it, but it really does inspire and help rejuvenate the creative process. Well, thank you so much, Verna. Where is Verna from, Trudy? Do we know? I'm not sure where she's from, but I appreciate it. Keep at it. And good luck to you. And, hey, if it's working for you, I'd love to give you a shout-out because it helps you get some little recognition, I think, for going through it and applying it to your own lives. But it also spurs other folks on. So reach out to the website, amybetharkowy.com. That's the place to go, too, if you need a little cajoling in the creativity department. We'll start a conversation. First one always on me. I'll go over the primer on the challenge as well as offer some other advice and tips and see if we can get your creative wheels moving in the right direction. Again, it's amybetharkowy.com. And while you're there, you can also peruse my stories, The Eliza Gordon Mysteries, both Killing Time and Dead Silent, available for ebook and paperback from Cozy Cat Press. And number three, well, we're working on it. Hopefully spring, it'll be ready. We'll see. Okay, so let's get down to it. Twitter feed, AB Writes, a lot of folks chiming in about the show in general, and particularly Carly Fiorina on The View. People were talking about that. A couple of folks just about our interviews. Johnny says, really good interviews. You have a way with your guests. The books sound intriguing. Yeah, okay, good. There we go. Trying to get you some new readers, ladies. And Stella says, fascinating. I enjoy finding out what goes on behind the scenes and how writers write. Indeed so. That's why we have them on. It is fascinating, the process, isn't it? Now, on Carly Fiorina, a lot of people are chiming in. She showed up on The View. This was her return visit after one of the ladies, I think it was Michelle Collins, made some kind of a joke about Carly Fiorina looking demented at the last debate because she couldn't take the smile off her face. Well, she's been making political hay out of that one for the last week or so by kind of, you know, taking a sharp tongue scalpel to the women on The View and talking about how horrible it is when liberals can't stand conservative women, et cetera. So she came back on via satellite. She wasn't at the table, so it was either more awkward or less awkward. I can't figure out which. She was via satellite from New Hampshire. And I'll just say my opinion is she is the one person who can really make Hillary Rodham Clinton look warm and fuzzy. There's an edge to this woman. She's very acerbic. She has a lot of false claims that she comes out with. But some people love her in the Republican Party. If you believe what she's saying, some people love her. She's a good speaker for sure. She's very self-assured. She's an accomplished person up to a point, although her business acumen is in question when she left HP in disaster with a $25 million golden parachute and 30,000 jobs shed. She claims she can create more jobs or lose more jobs in the economy. I'm not sure which when she comes back. And I find it interesting that she can't wait to take on Hillary Clinton because all Hillary Clinton has to call her accomplishment is that she's the first woman who might be president. But, you know, she will never run, she said on The View. She will never ask people to vote for her because I'm a woman, but because I'm the most accomplished person and the most qualified person. Yeah, up to the voters, as I said. And a lot of people are chiming in on The View, and some people are pro-Carly, which I was a little surprised to say. Allison signs in, Carly on The View, lost me at the litany of the left and the left's prescription for women. I have no common ground with her. Okay. Oh, so Allison is for the ladies on the left. She doesn't like what Carly had to say. I agree with you on that one, I think. Peggy, though, says, I can't stand The View. I wanted to see Carly on The View, and I'm reminded why I can't stand it. It's the rude hosts. A lot of people said they kind of cut her off. I saw it, and, yeah, part of it was the delay with the satellite, which is an issue that some people have with that. So sometimes that, I don't think it was their fault. But they don't agree with her on the issues, that's for sure. And so far she hasn't produced any proof regarding her outlandish claims about Planned Parenthood and that missing secret double probation video that she continues to talk about, which I find crazy when she talks about politics being a fact-free zone. They did all agree at the end that she liked Whoopi Goldberg's movies, and Whoopi said, yeah, I do. I like my movies, too. It was hard for them to contain some of their disdain towards her and what she said. And, of course, they did call her out on her comments. I don't think they brought up the Barbara Boxer comments that she insulted Barbara Boxer's hair on mic when she thought she was off mic during the Senate campaign. But they did call her out on using the comments that they made about her being demented, and, of course, Donald Trump. She got a big bump in the polls when Donald Trump said something nasty about her her face. She does have a hard edge to her. She just does. I mean, there's just no way around it. There's nothing warm and fuzzy about her at all, and not that you have to be warm and fuzzy, I guess, to be president, but you have to be relatable. And even if you disagree with someone, there can be some relatability, I guess, and I just don't see it. That's my opinion. There are people that love her, though. As I said, there are some people who are. Melody says, you call this a conversation? They aren't letting her finish a sentence, Carly on The View. Edie says, way to go, Carly Fiorina, for standing your ground on The View. Thank you for giving us a voice. Team Save the Babies. Hey, these are some pro-life folks. And again, people have a right to their opinions, absolutely, and you have a right to express your opinions. And my opinions are mine. They're not necessarily, it's not right or wrong. Everybody has their opinion. But you want to treat people fairly, and I guess they did. Again, it is sort of like ganging up on someone, I guess, if they all are going after her. I saw it, or saw most of it, I think, and I don't think they really were ganging up on her per se, but they did have some strong questions. She kind of dodged and weaved around the questions, as a lot of politicians do. That's how they do it. You know, it's interesting. Cindy says, The View demonstrates how rude liberals really are. But Bryn says, Carly Fiorina, she thinks she can be president. What a joke. Go View. So there you have it. Reach out your views at the Twitter feed, AB Writes, phone line 347-857-4505. And, of course, the other big name in the news this week is Ben Carson, who is, I guess, teetering just around Donald Trump. They've kind of evened out, and with the new debate coming out, Trump will still be center stage because he edged out Carson in the four polls they went with. But he's in the news because of his narrative, this backstory, which I guess he's been telling for years about how he was a violent youth and almost stabbed someone, and how he found God and has become a much calmer, sedate, seriously sedate person. And now they went to kind of vet this story by going back to Detroit and finding people who were there, and nobody could vouch for this story. And he was all over CNN this morning complaining about it and saying that, you know, in other words, you have really no right to do this, and why don't you vet the other side, which I always think is a joke. First of all, when President Obama ran and he wrote a book about his childhood, they did vet that story and go back. And they did found some inconsistencies, and the press did call him on it, by the way. People always say, well, how come they don't dish out the same kind of treatment to Hillary Clinton? And I'm like, are you kidding me? I mean, this woman has been eviscerated in the press for 20-plus years. So, you know, I take some quibbles with this idea that the liberal, so-called liberal mainstream media only attacks conservatives and Republicans. It's not true. Their job is to go after everybody, and you need to vet all these candidates, and you need to ask tough questions about not only where they sit on the issues, but also their backgrounds, especially stories you're putting out there. I mean, the irony of this whole Ben Carson kerfuffle is that he's trying to say that he was a violent person who had some kind of transformation and redemption, and some people are questioning whether that really ever happened or if he was just always a nice, sedate guy. So he's the one that put the story out. Most people don't want people to think that they almost murdered several people in their lives. That wouldn't be a calling card for higher office, one would think, but he's been living with this story for so long and telling it and changing it and embellishing it, as stories often do. As you retell stories, as people know who are dinner table raconteurs, as you start telling a story about something that happened in your life, it embellishes. My sister and I have this joke about an incident that occurred when we were on a trip once, and it became much more detailed and much crazier and much bigger than larger than life as we kept retelling it. So this happens all the time. There's nothing new about that, but it's just fascinating that he would want to tell a story that makes him look bad so that he could eventually look good, I guess. Fascinating. I'm fascinated by Ben Carson and his attraction to 23% to 26% of the Republican electorate. I don't know how he'll play on the main national, race stage, but who knows? You know, we've been wrong so far about Trump, too, so we'll see how this all plays out. And Bernie's going ballistic, too, because his poll numbers are plummeting, so now he wants to resurrect the whole email deal with Hillary Clinton. Oy, as they say, on the election stage. Anyway, it is the end of the third week show. Still time to weigh in. AB writes on the Twitter feed, phone line 347-857-4505. Want to get a few tunes in here as we honor yesterday Art Garfunkel's birthday. Art Garfunkel was 74 years old, partner in arguments with Paul Simon for many years, and very fascinating things to say about his relationship with Paul Simon. I just read an article recently where he talked about still having some bitterness over the breakup. It was Paul who initiated it because he wanted to do solo work. I always had thought it was a kind of a mutual decision because Art Garfunkel went on and did some acting as well, but it really was Paul, and he just said he couldn't understand it because Bridge Over Troubled Water had just come out, and it was such a big success, and why, he said, it's crazy to disband after such a great success. He also said that they were long childhood friends, and he became friends with him because he felt sorry for him because people picked on him because Paul Simon was so short. So I thought that was fascinating, too. But Art Garfunkel is the one who doesn't get as much credit, of course, because he didn't write the songs. And I don't really understand why, since he's written some poetry. But he has that great voice, and the voices work so well together. But solo, he's had a pretty impressive solo career, too. Saluting Art Garfunkel. Happy belated 74th birthday on the Amy Beth Arkoe Show.
I bruise you, you bruise me. Trying to get something on your radio.
Yes. And I was sitting here just like this. Now, that's the whole thing.
That's it.
That's what?
Huh? You've got your elbow on that switch. That's what sent it out over the air.
What a wonderful, wonderful world this would be. What a wonderful, 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 wonderful world. about the French I do.
Master's in math from Columbia University. In fact, intriguing factoid, he actually taught math briefly at a Connecticut prep school following the breakup of Simon and Garfunkel. Can you imagine Art Garfunkel as your algebra teacher? What a hoot that would have been. But he said he found after each lesson he would ask if anybody has any questions, and all the kids would say, what are the Beatles really like? It was the early 70s, and I guess he figured it was time to get back on the stage, and we're happy he has. Happy belated birthday, Art Garfunkel, turned 74 yesterday. Also celebrating a birthday yesterday, Peter Noon, the cherubic lead singer of Herman's Hermits, turned 68, and I guess he knew all the way back. You know, he kind of grew into his looks, but he had that big, mile-wide smile and the matching suits with his other British invasion brethren. He knew he was into something good. Here's a forgotten 45 for Frankie. Happy belated birthday, Peter Noon.
Woke up this morning feeling fine. There's something special on my mind. Last night I met a new girl in the neighborhood. Whoa, yeah. Something tells me I'm into something good.
Something tells me I'm into
When Donald Trump hosts tomorrow night. Are you watching? I think I probably am because I just got to see what they do, right? But apparently protests are planned by Hispanic groups and others outside NBC, and they might even have an ambush in the audience, which should be fascinating for a live show. So we have to watch to see what happens. So all better for the ratings, right? I mean, the man is a master showman. He knows how to get ratings. Interestingly, how to note, though, that NBC, when they cut ties with Trump last June, booted him off The Apprentice, they did make a comment that they did not support any of his volatile rhetoric. That's when he was very insulting and steaming up xenophobia against the Mexicans, etc. Well, his rhetoric really hasn't changed that much. He's toned it down here and there, but his popularity and staying power have proved so much so that they'll do it for ratings, I guess. But it's also fascinating, and I'm sure a lot of folks, including myself, will at least watch part of it to see how they handle it all. And will other candidates jump on board? I mean, Hillary was on for one segment. A segment here, a segment there has been known to happen, but very rarely do you see a political figure host the show. So we'll have to see how that all goes. And don't forget, if you haven't forgotten 45, you can reach out and let us know. We'll play it for you when we can. We got really backlogged with a lot of guests today, so we didn't get to as many, but we'll do it next time. You can send your forgotten 45 to the website, amybetharkowee.com. That's also the place for your Grateful Bounty requests. Our third annual Grateful Bounty at the end of this month will celebrate great music and our blessings. Get your requests in ASAP and no later than next Friday, November 13th, at the Twitter feed at AB Writes, hashtag Grateful Bounty, or the website. And don't forget, you can follow the 24/7 conversation on Twitter, also at AB Writes. Friend our producer, Trudy Hart, Twitter at Radio Trudy. You can friend me on Facebook, etc. You want to find me, you know you'll find me. And we want to be found. That's always the way it goes. In the meantime, drive safe, play nice, dream big. Please come back and see us on the Amy Beth Arkowee Show Tuesday at the Country Coffee Clatch with rising star Madeline Victoria. And so much great music with a side order of pop culture combo. Take care.
Midnight hour, it's where my love comes tumbling down, as Solomon Burke said, if you need